we've been at low oil prices for a while now, and I think it's the nature of the beast, right, that there are going to be consequences.
BP makes deep cuts to the number of rigs operating in Prudhoe Bay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, how much does the polar bear critical habitat designation matter for the oil industry? It depends on who you ask.
So in my experience, it adds paragraphs or pages to the length of a document.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
BP has announced it will cut the number of drill rigs operating at Prudhoe Bay from 5 to 2 as a result of low oil prices. Spokeswoman Dawn Patient says the decision came after BP's primary partners in the oil field, ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, asked the company to cut costs. It's the latest in a steady drumbeat of tough news from the oil patch as prices continue to hover around $40 per barrel. The cuts will not impact jobs at BP itself, but Renee Limoges-Reeve of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance says she expects layoffs at the three contractors operating the rigs, with perhaps 200 jobs affected. Limoges-Reeve says after a year and a half of low oil prices, the impacts on industry are starting to sink in.
Oil prices are cyclical, so people waited to see if it would come back and how quickly it would come back. And you know, we've been at low oil prices for a while now, and I think that it's the nature of the beast, right, that there are going to be consequences.
BP's Dawn Patient says the company will try to limit the impact on the amount of oil Prudhoe sends down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. A federal appeals court last week ruled that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was following the law when it designated a California-sized piece of the Alaskan Arctic as critical habitat for the polar bear. The ruling dismayed the state of Alaska, the oil industry, and several native groups. They challenged the habitat designation, saying it was too broad and would deter activity in the region. APRN's Liz Ruskin takes a closer look at this designation and what it could mean for the industry.
The first thing to know is that this habitat is an enormous area, but 96% of it is offshore, covering sea or sea ice. The 4% that's on land is a band of coast that stretches from the Canadian border in the northeast to Barrow and all the barrier islands down to Hooper Bay in western Alaska. U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Ted Swem says the habitat designation won't require anyone to get any new permits. For oil companies, he says, it just adds a question for federal permits they'd have to get anyway.
So in my experience, it adds paragraphs or pages to the length of a document, and that requires the project applicant and the federal agency with which we're working to add more text, and we have to add more thought and more discussion.
You can imagine the long email strings that ensue.
But it doesn't add weeks or months to the permitting process.
That's because, Swem says, regardless of whether the habitat is designated, the polar bear is listed as a threatened species. Under the Endangered Species Act, he says, any federal permit for development in this area of the Arctic already requires consultation with his agency to evaluate its impact on the bear. And here's the thing. Even without the habitat designation, Swem says, Fish and Wildlife still has to look at the impact on the habitat, because harming the habitat could harm the bear. Or, as Swem puts it,
in the case of the polar bear, every place there's critical habitat, there is also polar bears.
The habitat designation adds a new question, what's the impact on the bear's habitat? But the answer, Swem says, is roughly the same.
Not just roughly, but I would say it would be the same. It has been the same in my experience. The answer is the same.
Swem cites Point Thompson, the Exxon project on the North Slope, as an example. Exxon got the crucial wetlands permit for that in 2012 when the polar bear habitat designation was in place, before the legal challenge put it on hiatus.
And it was right on the coast, and it is in critical habitat, and I would contend that it didn't affect that development at all to have the project within critical habitat.
The Corps of Engineers wetlands permit required Exxon to bring two drilling pads in from the coast a bit and shrink a third to accommodate polar bears coming ashore. The Corps also required Exxon to pay compensation for filling 267 acres of wetlands at a 3-to-1 ratio by paying a conservation fund to preserve, 801 acres elsewhere. Exxon won't say how much they had to pay for that, but safe to say it was several million. Joshua Kindred, an attorney for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, an industry trade group, contends the habitat designation adds exponentially to that kind of cost.
You know, if an area of land in which, you know, say a developer wants to develop is critical, then the Corps puts sort of an automatic multiplier on the value of that land from a wetlands mitigation standpoint.
But according to the Corps of Engineers, there is no automatic multiplier.
There's no one thing that says, okay, this is habitat for a polar bear, therefore the wetland mitigation ratio is X.
That's Sheila Newman in the Regulatory Division of the Corps of Engineers. It's not easy to explain the Corps' evaluation methods. Newman says they examine wetland functions, but they don't have a standard assessment tool. Newman says they're trying to pare down the methodologies so companies can better predict their mitigation costs.
But, you know, we are not there yet.
Newman does say, though, that in all the assessment tools in use, it wouldn't make a difference whether an area is a designated critical habitat or just a place that has polar bears.
The critical habitat designation in itself does not make, in this instance, wouldn't make a difference at all.
Kindred from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association says the designation, if nothing else, adds uncertainty to a project. He says they haven't decided yet whether to pursue their legal challenge further. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iditarod mushers start the race with hardier sleds to accommodate the rough trail.
It is indestructible. And if anybody can break it, it'd be me. It's been tested and abused and it's still functioning.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A single gunshot that rang outside the Diamond Courthouse late this morning has left one woman dead and rattled the nerves in the heart of the capital city. Reports of the shooting came in just after 11 a.m. today. Police think 34-year-old Miranda Ellen Davidson shot herself in the chest with a handgun. No one else was hurt. Davidson was in the news last year after taking a hatchet to flat-screen televisions at Juno's Walmart. The courthouse, which has a security checkpoint and a metal detector at its public entrance, took additional security measures after the shooting. Across the street in the Capitol, lawmakers in the House cleared their chambers as the news spread. The House passed a bill today that provides civil immunity to those who administer an antidote that reverses overdoses from heroin and other opioid drugs. Anchorage Senator Johnny Ellis sponsored the bill. This made it unusual, since few bills sponsored by members of the minority party ever come up for votes. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The passage of Senate Bill 23 received unanimous support, with every representative present voting for it. If the Senate, which already passed an earlier version, approves of the current bill and Governor Bill Walker signs it, the bill would join a small group of minority Democratic bills that become law. Senator Ellis says the urgency to pass the bill came in part from the rising number of overdose deaths both in Alaska and nationally. The bill allows doctors and pharmacists to provide naloxone, or Narcan, a drug that reverses the effects of overdoses.
We have a heroin addiction overdose epidemic in the state of Alaska. And I knew that we had achieved a breakthrough when I heard Hillary Clinton talking about Narcan, this life-saving miracle drug to reverse opioid overdoses, and heard Chris Christie, who was vying for the Republican nomination for president, speak up in favor of the legislation.
The urgency over the issue was cited by Wasilla Republican Representative Lynn Gaddis, who worked with Ellis on the bill. Gaddis notes that the House has focused on budget bills recently, but leaders allowed the overdose antidote bill to advance.
But I also applaud leadership for recognizing that this is a life and death issue, for making an exception to this incredibly unique and critically important bill.
Since 2013, only 5% of bills passed by the legislature had minority caucus sponsors. That's because the Republican-led majority controls which bills receive votes. Ellis recalled that a similar pattern held when Democrats have controlled the majority. He says that over time, the minority bills that did advance had broad support, including backing from important groups. The overdose antidote bill was supported by the Alaska State Medical Association.
Yes, it really did help that the original idea for the bill, the original support was the State Medical Association. And Republican majority members often listen to medical doctors, and they wanted a release from civil liability.
While minority-supported bills that become laws have very different subjects, one thing they have in common is support from a broad coalition, one that has the attention of the majority. For example, Representative Jonathan Kreis Tompkins, a Sitka Democrat, was a sponsor of another prominent minority-sponsored bill. It made Alaska Native languages official languages in the state. He says that it helps when bills can draw on broad coalitions of supporters rather than narrow support.
I think if you focus on good legislation, it has a chance of passing. If you pick really ideological legislation that isn't shared by a majority of a body, it's less likely to pass, whether it's extreme to the right or extreme to the left. So, I think if you looked at, say, deeply conservative or deeply liberal legislation, the rates of passage for that kind of legislation is pretty low.
House Minority Leader Representative Chris Tuck, an Anchorage Democrat, says it can be frustrating that relatively few minority bills become law. He says he'd do it differently if he ever had the power to change it. Democrats haven't had a majority in the House in 22 years.
People ask me, well, Democrats are going to do the same thing when they're in power. Well, no, but yes. No, not initially. But if they reigned as long as this majority has had control of everything, then things start becoming more heavy-handed and more heavy-handed and more heavy-handed. So I think it's a really good idea to have the powers flip back and forth.
Ellis noted that Walker has signaled support for the bill, and he's hopeful that it will become law soon. From Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Yukon Quest champion Hugh Neff is the first musher out of Rainy Pass in this year's Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. He left the checkpoint just after 11:30 this morning without stopping for rest. Two veteran mushers, Jan Steves and Martin Koenig, scratched today, both at the Skwetna checkpoint. Steves was injured in an early crash, and Koenig became ill. Every Iditarod is difficult, but this year, mushers are preparing for a particularly bumpy, brutal ride on the trail's first leg. Many have modified their run strategies and adjusted one of their main tools for keeping a competitive edge, their sleds. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, durability is trumping speed for the sled mushers are starting the race with.
Rookie Tim Pappas is running a fast, young puppy team and made the decision to ride a heavier sled because it stands a better chance of not getting pulverized on ice and rocks.
So I can, give the sled a little bit more abuse. It sounds like it's going to be kind of a rough trail this year, so I think it's going to be the right choice.
Originally, Pappas had planned on switching sleds further along the trail to one with wooden runners that would have been lighter and faster. But given that conditions through much of the race are looking bare and rough, he decided to stick with his beater. It's a design crafted in-house at Martin Boozer's Happy Trails Kennel, where Pappas is a handler. And Boozer himself is opting for the same strategy. Runners made from a heavy plastic composite that puts durability ahead of speed.
I know it adds a bit of weight. It probably adds 5 or 8 pounds to the entire rig. But it also guarantees you virtual success going through some of the rough sections. because they literally cannot break.
Boozer says that this year he isn't racing to win, just finish.
So the joke is that this year's motto is how slow can you go?
Other mushers are building slow into their strategy too, or simply looking for ways to tamper their teams during a dicey technical descent out of the Alaska range and towards flatter trail conditions. Lance Mackey is spending the first part of the race on a bigger sled designed for the Yukon Quest.
It is indestructible. And if anybody can break it, it'd be me. So it's been tested and abused, and it's still functioning. So I'm taking this one to Nikolai to just kind of confirm that I'll have a dog team when I get to Nikolai.
On top of the sled's weight, he's taking other steps to budget his dog's energy. He modified his gang line and harness system to give the team less pulling power. Then from Nikolai onward, vroom, they're off.
And you get to Nikolai with a dog team, then you can race.
Another strategy for limiting pulling capacity in this first leg is just running fewer dogs on the line, as if you're taking cylinders out of an engine. Race veteran Kelly Maxner is running an aggressive schedule for a top finish, but he left the start in Willow with a multi-part sled that included, among other things, a hip-high plastic dog crate.
I'll carry up to four dogs, maybe even more, depending on what's going on out there, just because I'd rather be carrying dogs instead of slamming on my brake.
While many of the sleds departing Willow Lake had a caboose attached, plenty of mushers left with short, unburdened sleds, suggesting they've either dropped equipment at checkpoints further ahead or are in for a fast ride to Rhone. Reporting from the Iditarod Trail in Willow, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Get away and stay in Alaska at UAS Juneau. Small enough that your professors know you by name. Big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new freshman residence hall. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Southeast Alaska is growing older faster than any other region in the state. This so-called silver tsunami is expanding the need for housing, transportation, healthcare, and social services. Coast Alaska public radio stations are presenting a series of reports talking to our older community members and those who work with them about many of the issues they face. Our first Aging Southeast report, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld explores why our senior population is growing.
Mary Lou Spart sits in the parlor of Fireweed Place, a senior's apartment building in downtown Juneau.
Would you mind if I ask how old you are?
No, I don't mind. I'm 84. I'll soon be 85.
Illuminated by a stained glass lamp, Spart chats about aging in the city that's been home for most of her life. She says not long ago, she ran into a friend at a concert and both noticed something that's becoming more and more common.
We looked around the room, and he said, you know, these are the same people that were going to concerts 20 years ago, 25 years ago, except we're all turning gray or white.
Spartz is part of the fastest-growing demographic group in Southeast Alaska. She and about 9,200 others make up a little more than 12% of the region's population. That's almost a one-third increase over 5 years ago. It puts Southeast's average age at about 5 years older than Alaska as a whole. Melani Shivens, director of Juneau-based Rain Coast Data, says today's growing population has roots dating back almost 50 years.
You had in Alaska and in Southeast Alaska, you had this huge cohort of the baby boomer generation coming in the 1970s.
Boomers are defined as those born after World War II, primarily between 1946 and 1964. Once they grew up, they came to work in newly developed oil fields or on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. With a recession hitting the lower 48, still others moved for retail, construction, or government jobs created as oil revenue increased.
And that generation has really aged in place, and so you've seen this really big bubble of baby boomers sort of moving across the aging spectrums. And now that age bubble is moving into their older years.
Some people still head south for an easier climate, advanced medical care, or to be closer to family. But Alaska Commission on Aging Executive Director Denise Daniello says it's now easier to grow older without moving.
Alaska has a really strong base of supports, senior meals, transportation for seniors, homemaker services, along the continuum of care, which has really helped to support seniors being able to continue living, in their homes and in the community longer.
But that doesn't cover everyone. Most older small city and village residents can't find advanced care without moving to Juneau, Sitka, or Ketchikan. And if they do, they find a shortage of nursing home and assisted living beds, as well as specialists familiar with their problems.
We don't have a pulmonary doctor. We don't have a cardiologist.
That's Dr. Susan Hunter-Jerns, the only neurologist in Southeast Alaska. She helps diagnose dementia, among other disorders.
We don't have rheumatology, don't have plastic surgeon anymore, do have orthopedic and physical medicine rehab, but many times there's surgeries that need to be done that are not done frequently enough up here and have to be done down south.
Still, the region has seen growth in senior centers, housing, meal programs, village clinics, counseling, and home care programs. Southeast Senior Services Director Mary Ann Mills says one goal is to help people live independently as long as possible. That can be as simple as rebuilding a doorway to make a bathroom accessible or making sure a floor isn't too slippery.
When someone breaks a hip, oftentimes they'll go to the hospital and then live the remainder of their days in the nursing home, and their lifespan will be decreased.
She says institutional care can cost nearly $250,000 a year in Alaska. Home and community-based care costs about a tenth of that. While the growing older population stretches services, those programs are facing challenges as state and other government budgets shrink. Back at Juneau's Fireweed Place, Mary Lou Spartz ponders some of the frustrations of growing older in her hometown.
The attitude is people who, grow old, what are we supposed to do with them? They're just a burden. That's not the way I think we should be thought of.
And it should be no secret to anyone the numbers are growing. Researcher Melanie Shiven says we've known about this trend for a good 40 years. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
After a struggle that's lasted more than a decade, ancestral remains long removed from the Kodiak Archipelago will soon return home. Following excavation in the 1960s, the remains traveled to the University of Wisconsin and ended up at Indiana University, Bloomington. They've been the subject of study and research papers, but they're also the ancestors of Alaska natives in Kodiak who would like them to be returned for burial. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has the story.
Kodiak Island has a history of non-native archaeologists excavating and removing ancestral remains and artifacts. Aleutik Museum Executive Director April Lactonen Counselor says archaeologists in the 1960s did an excavation of a graveyard that was eroding onto a beach on Chirikoff Island, south of Kodiak Island, and removed the remains of approximately 150 people.
And from what we have heard, there was even, exposed coffins and things like that. So this is a graveyard from probably the early 1800s when there was a Russian settlement on the island. There was also historically Aleutic habitation.
The archaeologists transported the remains off island, and between then and now, they ended up at Indiana University. Counselor says she thinks of them as people's great-grandparents.
40 boxes of human remains stacked floor to ceiling, and it's really hard for me to remain emotionally neutral when I imagine that, because I think of my own grandparents, I think of my own village where this happened, where archaeologists during that time would come into the village, and even when people would say, please don't dig up our graveyard, they would just do whatever they wanted.
Counselor comes from Larsen Bay, where one landmark repatriation case took place in the late 1980s. The Larsen Bay Tribe and the Kodiak Area Native Association asked the Smithsonian Institution to return remains excavated in the 1930s. Aleutic Museum Curator of Collections Marty Leist says that case is part of the reason the Chirikoff Island remains will soon be coming home and reburied. It contributed to the establishment of a federal law called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA.
Many tribes around the country, have their ancestors and collections from their land scattered throughout the nation. And so this law was developed to help tribes and also museums to develop procedures so that there's a process for returning funerary objects, sacred objects, and human remains to tribes.
NAGPRA requires that federally funded institutions like universities and museums inform Native tribes and peoples if they are holding any artifacts or remains that are connected to them. Leist and counselors say the researcher at the university who was studying the remains did not do that. A U.S. Fish and Wildlife archaeologist made the discovery of the collection's whereabouts in the mid-2000s. Chirikoff Island is federal land and managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which means they also manage the remains. The archaeologist was documenting the organization's collection and discovered that many items had ended up at IU. The extent of the university's research on the remains is unknown, but anthropology professor Della Collins Cook has included her observations on the collection in several papers. Counselor and Leist are critical of Cook and the university for the delay and for failing to contact members of the Kodiak community about studying the remains of their ancestors. Leist says the university and Cook have an ethical responsibility.
Because these human remains have been on loan or whatever the circumstance may be at Indiana University, because they don't have control, that legal control, they technically never had to comply with NAGPRA, is their assertion. And we feel like that since these are literal ancestors for the Kodiak Aleutic people, that they should have lived up to the spirit of the law.
Cook did not agree to an interview with KMXT. Leist will travel to Indiana along with Army Corps representatives to retrieve the remains in early March. She will represent the Shunack tribe, who have claimed cultural affiliation with the remains on geographic grounds. Leist says she hopes the repatriation process will be completed by 2018 and they will finally be able to bury the Chirikoff ancestors. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. With reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ed Schoenfeld and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Willow, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN.
And by
GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.